Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 85 of the Free Cities Podcast. So, I've just asked Venice.ai, that's the ChatGPT for privacy-minded people, by the way, what is the significance of the number 85, since this is episode 85? And well, it's told me, quotes, in summary, the number 85 can symbolize a journey of transformation where material success is achieved through change and adaptability. It suggests moving towards a more balanced and fulfilling life, end of quotes. Well, I'm just going to go ahead with that interpretation because this episode is a somewhat unusual one, and I feel that it would definitely benefit from a little explanation before you go ahead and listen. Tour de Meester is an analyst and investor, probably best known and very well respected as a Bitcoin advocate. Personally, I've been a fan of his for quite some time, and I very much appreciate his ability to straddle the worlds of, on one hand, traditional finance, and on the other, esoteric Bitcoin mythology. And he does it very effectively, as far as I'm concerned. As a result, of course, I loved talking to him in person. We met at BTC Prague a few weeks ago, after his talks about, and this proves my point above, he spoke about Bitcoin ETFs, and his keynote was Bitcoin Europe's Mithril. Now, if you don't know what Mithril is, which I didn't look it up, basically his talk explored the growing danger of collectivism in Europe, as far as I'm concerned, through the lens of J.R.R. Tolkien's masterpiece Lord of the Rings. Anyway, something that may need explaining here, and something I would definitely advise you to check out even prior to listening to this, is Tour's interview that he did with Peter McCormack on What Bitcoin Did, the podcast, which was episode number 691, entitled From Psychedelics to the Bitcoin Boom. It was a few months ago. During this show, Tour recounts his incredible experience taking the psychedelic Ibogaine in an attempt to gain access to the source of some personal anxiety causing, amongst other things, insomnia that he'd been experiencing for many years. Now, firstly, if you don't know what Ibogaine is, well, go and look it up. My TLDR is that it's a relatively obscure West African hallucinogenic drug, traditionally used in religious ceremonies, but in its sort of contemporary incarnation, it's used as a treatment for serious addictions. Basically, it's a pretty full-on psychoactive and something not to be taken lightly in my experience. Anyway, on his first attempt, Tour had a harrowing 24-hour trip that very much caught my attention when I listened to him recounting it on What Bitcoin Did. As I'm not a stranger to these kind of experiences myself, and as a result, I couldn't help myself jumping feet first into this experience in our podcast, and also the wider world of spirituality, personal journeys, etc. Now, I must admit that from my part in the conversation, I'm being a bit chaotic here, so you'll have to forgive me for that. The truth is, I had so much that I wanted to discuss with Tour, but only 1.5 hours in which to do it, which obviously was nowhere near enough time. However, what I was trying to do was conjure up the understanding that what Tour had experienced on his Ibogaine trip and what we are all experiencing in our daily lives are somewhat similar, and that is summed up best with the title of this episode. As Tour says in the conversation, let's identify how we are shackled. I think many of us are stumbling through life without ever noticing the shackles that are defining our actions. This is also true for our money, of course, as we discuss in this conversation. But the thing I was trying to convey is that change begins with the acknowledgement and experience of awareness. When we become aware of our shackles, be they suppressed childhood experiences or fiat money systems, from the position of awareness, we can begin to let them move on and become unstuck, as Tour likes to call it. This is an episode about finding hope in dark places. And I'll be the first to admit, it's a pretty weird one. But I hope you can distill some truth in here. Some things that may help you on your own personal journey to freedom in these chaotic times we live in. Anyway, podcast at free-cities.org with your questions and comments. And last week I forgot to mention that the short documentary I directed on special economic zones came out last week. And you can watch it for free on YouTube. Just search Zones of Progress, the past, present and future of special economic zones. We've had 10,000 views already and the message is definitely starting to get out there. Don't forget, Free Cities Telegram group is the place to connect with like-minded people in our space. Details in the show notes. And then, of course, before I leave you, one final request from me to you. As always, please just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Tour de Mista. So this piece of paper here, which is a complete mess, was me listening to you speak a few times last night and just jotting things down. And like I say, what I realized was there's a huge thread running through all this stuff, I think, anyway. The only part that's slightly unusual is the Ibogaine bit. But the Ibogaine is the way you discover the essence of all these things, I think. Because for me, that was my journey with psychedelics was a journey inward, as you've obviously discovered. Funnily enough, I mean, I will do a big intro to this episode to explain all this stuff, so we'll just go straight into it.
Okay? No problem at all.
But what's fascinating about, I'll just say about Ibogaine first, because I've been collecting books for about 30 years, and I collect a lot of literature about psychedelics and stuff, and I've always looked at Ibogaine, but it was always the one in the book that was, like, scary. You know what I mean? There was the pictures they used, the way they described it, the uses of it. It was always, and I never actually went there. And I'm absolutely fascinated by the reason you decided to go straight for Ibogaine, because it said, as we just you just said that you've had a limited experience with psychedelics, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Why'd you go straight for Ibogaine?
Well, I mean, I did talk to quite a lot of people who had done psychedelics, and one of the, I mean, definitely I've heard people talk about LSD as, like, you know, I remember, like, Robert Crumb, like, saying, like, just, you know, and then there is Harrison of the Beatles, who's also, like, you know, that one time it just opened up his mind, and he did it more often than that, but, like, in some way that was enough. And then, but I did meet other people who would just be like, they would have done ketamine for years or do ayahuasca and then do it 30 times. And I was like, I just have this unidentified anxiety and insomnia, and I want some answers. And I feel like if something gives me some answers, I don't need to do it 30 times. So that was kind of my thinking. And then maybe it's also that I am a little bit of an extreme person. Like, I kind of just like to, if there is a bottom, I want to find it. And so it's like, why not just go there? I mean, and I, Yeah, I luckily lived to tell the tale. It was a risky endeavor. I'm actually not that much of a risk taker, I think. Like, I'm always careful. Like, I barely ever get injured, knock on wood, like those kind of things. Like, I don't do extreme sports. But apparently in this realm, I was like, yeah, like, I want to get to the bottom.
That, I think that's a very common experience. I'm exactly the same. Very conservative in normal life, risk-taking wise, but very interested in unusual things. And when it comes to observing the inner self, which is the journey of all this stuff that we're interested in, Bitcoin, culture, society, all these things, they are helped by this understanding of ourselves. I mean, for far as I'm concerned, the better I understand myself, the better I understand what's going on, and the better then I can sort of operate out in the world. Did you know, with Ibogaine, did you know how bad it could be? I mean, you know, people take mushrooms, people take LSD, and you can see the percentage of people that even are sick, which is not many, and bad trips happen occasionally. But Ibogaine's one of those drugs that's like, yeah, get ready for...
It's almost guaranteed to be a nightmare, right? Yes. I mean, there's not a lot of people that say, oh my God.
Yeah,
it's almost guaranteed. It's like it'll like yank your unconscious and just like push it in your face. And I was as far as you can be, because I've never been there, right? I didn't know what that world was going to be like. There was a lot of stories and metaphors that people would use to talk about it. My cousin said it's like 20 hours of your worst nightmares and then it's heaven. So he had a cathartic experience even in the trip, whereas for me, my gray day was just complete paranoia. So to some extent, I was prepared, but I had not encountered people that had the kind of existential questions that I had. There was one video of an Australian guy, but he had like done it at home and like done way too much without literally him alone in his apartment. And so, yeah, he had this existential crisis and then it took him like 6 months. But I'd heard stories like that about mushrooms as well. And so I thought, well, that's just an outlier. And then, you know, it seems like there I was, although it wasn't that extreme. But it took me definitely a year and the second trip to actually get some answers as to what's going on.
I mean, one of the things that absolutely screamed out at me, because it was an experience I'd had, and it was a really poignant experience in my life when I look back, was, and I'm pretty sure it was this, that I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but I think this is what turned me on to what you were doing originally when I listened to your first encounter with Ibogaine, was at the point where you said, you described the feeling of despair for eternity. Is that right? Was that?
Oh yeah, that's how that was actually in the second trip.
Oh, was it the second one?
I wrote it in
right?
my diary. I was like, I was looking back, I was in my paranoid phase, but I wasn't feeling so physically terrible. And I was looking back on earlier in the trip and remembering the fear. And so, yeah, it was like, and I was trying to, in a way, I was trying to warn myself against the desire to ever do this again.
Right. Well, I've had that experience. And I remember intellectually, because I talked to myself about it for so long. Mm-hmm. And it was that exact definition, or something like infinite regret or despair. They might be very intricately connected. But the important part was forever.
Yeah.
That you're in this place now. This is hell and you're here forever and it's despair. But for me, the way it manifested was it was a disconnection from everything that is. That the despair was that I was no longer part of everything.
Yeah.
And ever since that happened to me, I'm getting shivers now just thinking about it. I've been so grateful about everything, because it teaches you to understand that this is pretty cool where we are. All this stuff going on.
Yeah.
There are good people everywhere. Yeah. If you're a Bitcoiner, you know the love that Bitcoiners share amongst each other, but all this kind of stuff. But when you're in that experience, it's infinite.
It's like it's showing you death. And I remember the first trip, I didn't know, intellectually, I didn't know what is my worst nightmare. And it wasn't to die, because my lived experience of that trip was my brain, my whole being is being enslaved by some outside force, and it's going to control my will. It's taken over now, and it'll eventually completely control my will, and I will be trapped in being conscious in this body forever, like a slave. And so it's like weirdly, like, it's counterintuitive, because I think often I would say like, oh yeah, it's to die. That's my, but it's like, no, it was actually to be a slave and to be aware of it for the rest of eternity. That is hell, right? I mean, there's literally hell.
Well, hell, yeah, hell is whatever.
But I mean, in terms of mythology, like that's often what's described. It's not like, oh, this horrible torture and then nothing. Yes. It's like, no, it's suffering forever.
And well, the other thing you realize is it's now as well. It can be now. There are people living in hell now who you know.
Yeah. And oh yeah.
And that's a harrowing thought when you think about it. Interestingly, I've actually had a death experience as well, which was not related. Well, it could well be related to all this stuff. I started dying once, lying on a bed. I was ill. Wow. I wasn't that ill.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was pretty ill, and I was at home when I was quite young, and I started to die. What interestingly happened was, firstly, I recognized the process instantly.
And wow.
Wasn't unusual at all. It was very much a process.
But it was the first time it ever happened to you.
Sure, yeah.
But you knew what last was going time, on.
Yeah, absolutely. It was it was so recognizable as death, because otherwise I wouldn't have known what was happening to me. But it was like, oh, I'm dying. And ironically and strangely, the reason why I actually didn't die was because I thought about it and went, this is ridiculous. Why am I dying? My mum's going to find me lying on the bed here. This is absurd. But anyway, and I came back.
Just out of curiosity, like, was it like you couldn't breathe anymore?
No, it was a very gentle moving down. It's a bit like saying moving down my body and through my body, but it wasn't. But that's kind of how I was like feeling it. The other thing that in that moment of understanding it, the other major understanding which I brought back to this date was it was a birth. And a birth into something. And that was really like mind-blowing for me. I've never really, I've never feared death in the same way since. I mean, I fear death now because the thought of leaving my children is the most horrendous thing I could ever think of. But other than that, I'm pretty cool with the idea of getting old and doing my time and then moving on to the next thing because of this experience. But anyway...
Well, that's pretty profound, I think. I mean, when I read, I haven't read all the book, but I think the point of Brian Murarescu's The Immortality Key is that back in the days of the ancient Greeks, they somehow figured out that through the Eleusinian mysteries, like whatever that was, but potentially like a psychedelic ceremony, they allowed people to help them die before you die, to have that experience so that you then in your later life have a more peaceful acceptance of the eventual death.
Wow, I've never heard of that.
It came out 4 years ago, I think, the book. And so he did lots and lots of physical research. Like he went to Eleusis, which was a town outside of Athens. And there seems to be a lot of evidence that, you know, it was a pilgrimage, and a lot of the philosophers talk about it, but it was secret. Like, you could not talk about what happened there.
But like an initiation.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you did it once in your life.
Yeah. Which is something that is sorely missing from contemporary society.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting that Bitcoiners talk about initiations, and I've noticed a resurgence of it. Even over this weekend, I've seen a few people talking about what the future might hold and how to create culture around what's going on. Because I think this, my experience of learning about Bitcoin originally was that it helped me to shape a number of my sort of like personality traits. I wouldn't say that it generated them. I would say that it showed me to feel good about them, to decide, okay, I was misled somehow by culture, the culture around me. And I was brought back and it taught me it's okay to think like that, number one. It's okay to readopt all these personalities, like the unfolding, like the onion, stripping it back, which is the psychedelic experience as well. Again, you know, finding the essence of you and this, you know. But what I want to talk about then is this... mess of things that I've written down here. Because,
by the way, I hope you don't feel rushed, because I'm very happy to do this again sometime.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. No, absolutely. But you live in America, right?
I live in Austin, but I mean, I have family in Belgium, and you know, I come to
we unfortunately, we do all our podcasts in person. That's
which is going to be my rule from now on as well. I'm not going to do Zoom anymore.
Okay, right. Yeah, yeah. But that ends up being expensive. I get 3 trips a year, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So
no, but I mean, if I are you in London or?
No, I'm on a farm in Herefordshire.
Oh, well.
We're in the middle of nowhere. But you're welcome to come, for sure.
I see, I see.
Lots of strange things happen on our farm, I can tell you that much. Okay, so I'm thinking about here, the things that you're into and the crossovers with Free Cities, and architecture was one of them. And you started talking, I saw a talk you did about the future of sort of buildings and architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we the Three Cities Foundation, we were already there, exactly. And I looked through what you were saying, listening to it. I recognized all the talking points because they reflect a certain personality type, let's say. And I like your connection with Vitruvius and his three pinnacles. You know, the durability, usefulness, and beauty, which are all characteristics which are on the rise again. And when you look at the opposition to what we're all doing here, let's say, the world that we see around us, I like to call it the fiat world. I know there's a bit of a meme.
It's a good shorthand.
The fiat world is not durable. Usefulness, you could argue there is, but the incentives is not necessarily to be useful.
It's also like useful to whom and useful in what time frame.
Right. You know? And beauty is gone out the window, and it's no more obvious than in buildings. And we're in one now. We're in a commie block.
Yeah.
If you go into the middle of town, there are beautiful buildings from periods. First of all, do you think? Can you see the connection between all these things and Bitcoin and people and the changes that have occurred and the historical process of where we've got to here? I.e. let's call it fiat world. Fiat world, the short-term thinking, the collective ideas, even the democratic process, which is a kind of... I'm not a fan of the democratic process. And I think in this current situation, it's not working very well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's also short-circuiting because, you know, once you start making education funded by the government and controlled by the government, then, well, but the people are supposed to control the government. And what happens if the government starts to indoctrinate the people from childhood? You get a short circuit, you know? So, yeah, no. I mean, so in terms of Bitcoin and maybe even culture as a whole, I feel like a culture is like an operating system. It's kind of like under everybody's skin. It's unconscious. But it kind of dictates or very strongly influences choices people make in the aggregate. And the interesting thing about Bitcoin is that it's not really an operating system. It's not that complex, but it's a protocol that really disciplines behavior. It'll in that sense, it reminds me of Ibogaine, because like the experience of the first couple hours of Ibogaine is very strongly that there is an expected thing for you to do. And if you deviate, you get immediate like punishment, like that.
That
was my experience.
Being sick as well.
The nausea. The like if you're moving too fast, you just know you're gonna get sick, and you're gonna. I didn't throw up, but I mean, you know it. It's gonna happen, but it's also there's psychological pain that can be induced, and that's why it's so effective against addictions, because it's like you try to go into the distraction, you try, and then it immediately catches that and punishes you. But in that sense, Bitcoin is a bit like that, where if you follow the rules and you store your own coins and you do it responsibly and you don't gamble, you get a long-term reward. It's pretty incredibly substantial, like 50% a year on average. But if you deviate, you experience a lot of pain. Like you store your keys online, you're reckless, you go do deals with a scammy exchange, you try to multiply your coins, like, you know, you get pert. And it's, of course, that's a very simple mechanism, but it actually disciplines behavior. It's like a trainer, you know, who just he's unbiased. You can't sweet talk him. He's always just going to give it to you the way the rules are going to do it. And so in that sense, it's kind of helping us. That was maybe my talk yesterday. It's like it's helping us remember, like, because we had values that used to be in line with Bitcoin, like property rights and very simple things. So it's like collectively it's helping us remember.
It's quite easy, though, then to see. I mean, I'm jumping ahead here, but it's very easy to stand back, look at what you said, and say it appeared right now very naturally. It was always going to appear now as a counterbalance to what is going on. Mm. And as, I mean, the reason we find ourselves in this situation now are X, Y, and Z. And the reason why we have the opportunity or the ability to discover the technology of Bitcoin and then to sort of start adopting it and to start thinking about it and start using it is just a natural counterweight to the situation we find ourselves in. And if you look, I mean, me personally, if I look over the very long term, it's almost certainly the case that this was naturally occurring and we'll just make sure that it's just resetting the balance a little bit. We're going back towards the middle again and eventually. But the question is, I suppose, well, first of all, do you think that's true? And secondly, does it then deviate back the other way? I mean, is this...
Yeah, wait, can we do the first one?
Yeah.
I'll forget otherwise. Basically, was Bitcoin... Was it destined to happen? I guess I haven't thought about that much. I just sense I'm hesitating a bit. And I guess the more conservative way to talk about this would be that there is always the people that have a certain ethical framework, they instinctively feel that technology and you know, voluntary trade and business is a way to promote change in society. And so I would say, yes, it was always bound to be something on the technological track that would allow us to get a strategic advantage over the addiction to fiat and this kind of degradation of the culture. But I don't know if it was, you know, it was meant to be Bitcoin. Like, just like, you know, if you look back, the printing press, like, that gave a strategic advantage. Information was spread very quickly by people that were forward thinking and that weren't stuck in a bureaucratic framework like the universities at the time or the powers that be. It was very bootstrap. Like, I think, not that I'm a huge fan of, like, Luther's 95 Theses, but I forget how many thousands of copies spread all around Europe in just a couple of months. It was incredible. It just, like, poof. You know, it was almost like the Twitter of the time, like these little pamphlets. So like, none of these people in the banks and in the bureaucratic institutions caught on Bitcoin for 10 years. Like, we just did whatever we wanted. And it's only now, maybe 15, right? And it's only now that they're like, hey, what's going on? And so, you know, there is a kind of a, strategically, it's very interesting, right? That if you look at what percentage of Bitcoin is owned by people that share the actual cypherpunk ethos, it's pretty high.
Mm. It could be, I mean, talking about the printing press and thinking about it in terms of that, you could easily say it's the internet itself then that is the invention or the discovery. And it's actually the creation of a new realm, the digital realm, which it existed, but we had no access to it prior to, you know, whatever, in the 70s or whenever it was. And that is the place where all this incredible consciousness expanding stuff is happening. And Bitcoin is the only way I can see that really anchors this world into that world. Is that your
kind of... I think that's profound, because it kind of, like, you know, it's a picture that you're painting that I think that's a lot more organic, that, like, you know, this internet emerged and then Bitcoin is, like, you know, it's almost like a universe, and then Bitcoin is a large star within that universe that also emerged. And then, yeah, it tethers the digital world to the physical world in such an elegant way. It is like a coordination mechanism, right? It helps the economy calculate. It's like how many resources. I mean, it's not just that, but a big part of it is like there's that question, like, how do I know how many resources need to be allocated to the digital realm or to the physical realm? Well, Bitcoin helps us make that decision.
Something I just picked up on the question before. Sorry, we're moving so fast here. Is I'm just thinking too many thoughts, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's great.
But you were talking about addiction to fiat, and that's a strong word, addiction. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by that?
I mean, I've grown to define addiction as any behavior that helps you avoid feeling your feelings. Hmm. So if you're dissociating, you're just trying to escape the current reality that is here, you are addicted. And so it's very broad, and it actually helps me because it's tempting to always want to not define yourself as an addict. It's like, oh, you know, I don't shoot heroin, so I'm not an addict. Or like, I'm a social drinker, so I'm not, you know, or I don't drink and do drugs. But it's like, yeah, but I scroll for hours and hours on social media. Like I just, and that was like what was happening to me in the period before I did my first ibogaine retreat or treatment, is that I became so aware of the addictions that I was having. Like it was so painful to realize like I'm scrolling, I'm doing it, and I can't stop. Whereas before I would even dissociate from the awareness that I was doing something that I was escaping. Anyway, it's a long, but so fiat addiction, I think, yeah, I mean, I don't know, because you could say like, well, fiat is like, it is like a drug because you get the dopamine right now. And so what are you avoiding? I guess you're avoiding the knowledge that our system is kind of messed up. Like that's one thing that you're avoiding.
Aren't you avoiding,
you're getting a shot in the arm and
aren't you avoiding the work?
The work that otherwise would need to be done,
exactly,
to get that capital. Oh yeah.
Well, the proof of, I mean,
or that you haven't earned it.
Yeah,
the knowledge,
exactly,
that you actually haven't earned the $1 million that came your way at 2% interest. Hmm. That's great. Yeah, I like that.
Well, no, I've every time I discuss, broadly speaking, all these things, I often come back to proof of work, and which is just the deepest and most hard part of the rabbit hole to grasp. I think you can understand it, but when you realize that proof of work is the philosophy that underpins a lot of it, I think that anyway.
Oh, absolutely. That's what sets Bitcoin apart from all the crypto, you know, all the other coins.
Right, but in your life as well.
Yeah.
A good example there, you have two choices. One is to work for 30 years on a business and generate and build up $1 million worth of capital. The other is to talk to your friend at the bank and say, give us some money, and there you go. You get it in 2 days or 3 days. One has an incredible proof of work, and it's visible in hopefully in the real world. You know, everything has a proof of work. Mm-hmm. You can look at anything and you can see the proof of work in it. But then this other one is hollow, completely hollow, and unfair.
I would add destructive as well. Like one concept that you're going to talk to Alan soon, Alan Farrington.
Yeah,
he calls it the capital strip mine, right? Because you borrow the dollars or the pounds, whatever. And it's like, oh, now I can plunk down a building. But what you're doing in the process is you're raising down some beautiful building, a beautiful villa that was built in the 19th century to put down 20 units. So you're stripping away the cultural capital and the physical capital of the world to just have a short-term gain for yourself. So it's more than just, you know, you yourself are physically dissociating. It's
is there also an opportunity cost there of not building something phenomenal?
Course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because, you know, I was talking about on another podcast, we were talking about this, it was the Czech podcast here, that the Austrian economists, when I was studying Austrian economics, the big mind-blowing moment to me was like, oh my God, the business cycle is not like the weather that is just, oh, it just comes and goes and it's a bad period and you can't do anything. No. You know, we can totally avoid this. That was like my big aha moment, and you get that from a lot of the Austrian literature. But what is harder to grasp is exactly the opportunity. Where could we have been? What could we have built if we hadn't allowed all this capital to be wasted on these bullshit projects, or like how Michael Saylor puts it, all the energy to be leaked away, right? It just evaporates into nothing.
Yeah. Let's talk about beauty, because I think this is really interesting concept, and you see it in architecture, you see it in software, you see it in your relationships, you see all this kind of stuff. And there's an inverse correlation, I think, between communistic ideas and beauty, I think, certainly in architecture. And that's because I think, you know, if your beauty is like a rebellion against nihilism, isn't it? And really, you know, I'm only just thinking of this now, but that in itself is...
I would say beauty disproves nihilism. Like, I think beauty is true. Like, it's real. Right? I mean, it's not just a reaction against. It's not just like you're trying to stay away from this gravity pull of nihilism. It's like, no, nihilism is just denial of reality. And the you know, like a campfire. You know, a campfire is a fire. Okay, if you stick your hand in it, it's going to hurt you like hell. If you're in Siberia and there's a campfire and you're 100 yards away, you're going to freeze to death. So in either situation, you get beauty. But if you sit right beside it at the proper distance, you know, if you respect the laws of nature, you have a beautiful experience of like spending a night in the taiga with your campfire, you know? And so to me, Marxism and whatever is just denial of reality and trying to trick people into believing that there is no, like campfires are ugly. You know, we don't need it. Maybe we're never going to make one. What's the use of it? I feel really strongly about this because I was in the fog and the hellscape of relativism myself. Like it made me suicidal. Like to believe that truth didn't exist. You know, so it's important to me to like stress. Like I think nihilism is just confusion and propaganda.
Why hasn't anyone said Bitcoin is beauty then? Mm. I've not heard that before, because that would be a really nice meme, wouldn't it? Because there's two B's in it as well. But that would be true, right? Bitcoin is
beauty.
Yeah,
and I mean, also, you know, if you read Aristotle, like they say, they often translate Aristotle's, you know, the ultimate virtue as the noble. You know, he says, oh, it's about the noble. But the word is tokalon, which is the beautiful. That is the actual translation of what he believes is the ultimate virtue, is the striving for the beautiful, which means, you know, balance, harmony, those kind of things. And so, yeah, if you know, Bitcoin is a system that, I don't know if Bitcoin itself is beautiful. I think yeah, in a way it is, because it unlocks so much beauty. So how can it not be beautiful itself, right? If it does that.
Did you, on your Ibogaine experience, first or second, did you discover beauty then? It's interesting because you were talking about the kind of very distinct funnel structure that this drug sends you down, and it points out your addictions, mm-hmm. like your fear addictions as well. And if you go there, it's such a painful, it's like an electric fence to bring you back.
Yeah, exactly. And then, exactly. You
know, right. So where does beauty fit into all that?
I would say it came after. So like generally what's described is you have your kind of the day that you are just laying flat and you're it's very like, I think part of why it's so powerful is that you're in a dream state. And so your body just relaxes and is just, if you don't move, it's actually comfortable to physically lay there, even though you're barely moving at all for 20 hours. And then there's a, so your brain is just doing so much work. And then they say the second day, which you're still in that dream state, is the gray day, but you're more able to talk and you can write a little bit in your diary or something, like walk around just a little bit. But so for me, it was after I landed, after I woke up, because it is a very distinct experience that like almost the first time anyway, for me, it was like this wave went over my body and whoop, and I was back and all the paranoia was gone. But so yeah, I'm trying to like be concise. So the experience of beauty, maybe there's two kind of components. One is just physically, like you feel like you're 6 years old and you're so clean. And apparently physiologically, it actually resets your dopamine receptors. So you're almost like reset in many ways. And it's hard to describe how amazing it feels to have like that, I don't know. It's like you just came out of a shower, but like, you know, 50 times better. But then
a molecular shower.
Yeah, right. But the second experience, definitely what came for me after the second trip, which is what, you know, I just went to bed and then at like, you know, 4 in the morning, I think, I woke up, started feeling some anxiety. And I had that, flashback of what I think is early childhood trauma. And I went into it and I did my Peter Levine exercises to like try to process it in the moment. And so as I was validating the trauma from whatever, maybe 40 years ago, I wept and I had a lot of relief. And to me, that was the experience of beauty. And like going back to the campfire analogy is like, I started placing it in perspective. I started seeing the root of what was a lifelong, permanent, confusing anxiety in my body. It was like, this is where it came from. And so being aware, like, oh, it's almost like I was blind and I was stumbling around and I would kind of walk from the snow into the hot coals and back in the snow. Whereas like, oh, now there's a fire. It's always been here. I didn't know. And so now I can start working with the trauma because I've actually identified where it is. Yeah. I've never thought about it that way, but that's what I would say is like, you know, the best way to describe like how I was able to have a beautiful experience. Invite beauty back into my life, so to speak.
Or as you say, if you define beauty as the acknowledgement of reality,
yeah,
that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's just the reality was hidden prior to that point and you saw it. Or I mean, I was thinking, as you were saying, it's a bit like having a broken leg in a cast but not realizing it.
And stumbling around.
And then one day you look down and go, oh, right, it's there.
Yeah.
Maybe I could work about taking that cast off. But in the beginning, I can just not put so much weight on it because actually it's going to cause me pain. You know?
And I don't know if you agree, but I feel like in a way, I want to kind of put us in one basket, like us Brits and Belgians, in the sense that I think we often have this brain in a vat type experience of life, like, oh, you know, it's all about the cerebral stuff and we're like stumbling around and hurting ourselves and not realizing what we're doing. And it's often a challenge to reconnect with the reality that we actually have a body and it, you know, it feels good to go on a bike ride and, you know, have enough sleep and those kind of things.
And from my personal experience, at the core of what you've just said then is the experience of what I would call, the best way to describe it is awareness, which is something.
Awareness is something. Yes, but I used to think it was cerebral. I used to think.
Yeah, you're right. Okay.
Yeah.
But it's, the time it's that you are aware of your brain, you realize, oh, the awareness is something different.
Yeah. What is the thing that's aware of my thinking?
Right.
Right.
But awareness is a really important part of this whole thing, I think, because most people are unaware of it. And as a word, it's very difficult to describe what it is, but the word awareness does do it justice, I think.
I think so.
You know, and I think you can train yourself, this is my experience, to reside in your awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, oh, I'm going here, I'm here, I'm here. And you just let go of your thought process a bit. And there, with the awareness, you do discover a lot of these things. And I think this is what psychedelics often do to you, is they nudge you a little bit to let go of the thought process.
Well, yeah, I remember an experience, I think it was on mushrooms, where it's a little bit, it's not as extreme as on Ibogaine, but it's still like, I wanted to distract and it like was uncomfortable. It was very uncomfortable to start going into the dissociating or
distraction. It's a good
literally
word.
Distracting. Yeah, yeah. It's like no, you got to be here. You know, it was like you are much more like a dog than you think you are. So be like a dog and feel what your body wants to do, which is sit under a tree in nature. And feel the grass.
I think of it,
for example,
it's like a monkey mind, isn't it? It's like your mind is just like doing all this stuff,
right?
A lot of it involuntarily, especially these days.
Well, I don't know if you agree, but I think often it's a coping mechanism that you develop very early. I don't think a baby has it, but I think if you are confronted with overwhelming emotional experiences when you're very young, and there is no aid in helping you process that, then you develop the monkey mind, which is in a way helping you survive. Like you kind of escape into the, like I used to read almost, I want to say compulsively. I would read the newspaper. I would read the milk carton. I would read the cereal, anything. I would just constantly, and which is why I became an analyst. It's like a way to kind of channel my former addiction, you know. It became an analyst.
That's phenomenal. So you think you became an analyst as a distraction from what you were feeling in your body, let's say.
Yeah. So oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's an amazing observation, I think. Do you know what, though, as well, though? And this is, now it's going to get a little bit out there, but...
love it.
You spoke about generational trauma, I think, on a podcast I listened to, particularly about Flanders. Are you from Flanders, right?
Yeah, Bruges, yeah. West Flanders.
Okay,
yeah.
So a lot of fighting in World War One, wasn't it? It wasn't the Western Front.
It was pretty brief, but it was known as, like, it was one of the first countries that got hit hard. And so poor little Belgium, that's the phrase that came from that. The army was overwhelmed. And then so from the beginning to the end, in both wars, Belgium was almost entirely occupied by the Germans for the whole span of the war.
Right, so the theory is that there is such a thing as generational trauma. This literally passed through your genes, right? And would you say you're an advocate of that idea now?
I don't know if I would call it genetic. I definitely think that because there's so much being transferred between parents and children, like even in the womb, right? If your mother has very high amounts of stress because of trauma that she's maybe inherited, even you just pass that on by just very, you know, because you absorb, your brain is so malleable, and you're, you know, if your heart gets transplanted, there's literally memories that get transplanted with it. Like, it's the most bizarre phenomenon. So I don't know if it's genes, but like clearly there is a very powerful transfer from generation. And I feel like it helped me a lot to have a lot more compassion with my parents, my grandparents, just to think that sometimes trauma is so big and you've inherited from multiple generations, it's almost impossible to say, I'm going to process all this trauma in my lifetime so I don't pass it on to my kids. But you kind of do what you can. Like you can, there's very powerful ways to actually process trauma and then kind of slowly help the next generation heal, you know, because you pass on less. Like one way to look at myself that resonates, like to, again, with this awareness, I think that unconsciously I saw myself as like a soldier who's on guard. Like I'm not like in a fight shooting, but like I'm there, I'm ready for whatever may come. On a moment's notice, I can, you know, jump into action. And so, which explains why it's hard for me to for a long time to actually get emotional or to actually be vulnerable. Cause it's like that gets in the way of, you know, that readiness to just put out the fire or, you know, jump into action. And so, yeah, I think that's not just me. I think a lot of people, like there's a lot of songs and literature that I think implicitly refer to that in Flanders, like especially among men, like that's why, like you teach your kids, like no whining, no, you know, like that, you know, be tough, you know, that's because literally some people just, it's almost weird, right? You talk to a friend and they're like, yeah, this is for when the Russians come. Like, you know, it's like, you're like, oh man, like you really beefed up your house there. And they'll be like, yeah. And then they're joking, like it's for when the Russians come, you know. It's like, well, I think that's a generational thing. It's not just a joke.
That's interesting. Yeah. I've got another take on it, which is, like I say, a bit out there, but it's worth mentioning. So years ago in the 90s, I used to live in Indonesia, and it's a really fascinating place. I was in Java for almost a year and a half. And I met a Buddhist teacher there, and I used to just study with him once a week. He was a very he taught meditation. I learned super huge amounts about myself from this one guy. He's dead now, unfortunately, but he was a phenomenal guy. And he was like a Buddhist on paper, because in Indonesia you had to have on your ID card, you had to be one of the five registered religions. But he was very much more interested in other things as well. And that part of Central Java has some very fascinating, indigenous religions. Mm. Anyway, they used to, local people used to come and see him all the time who had problems, like which we would now call trauma. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget this one time, because I used to sit and watch what would happen, because he would, in his case, he believed in past lives. And he would take them back to the past life from which this trauma came, because they couldn't identify. So in his meditations, we would identify trauma. And if you couldn't identify it because it wasn't from this life somehow, in another session, he would take you back. And I saw one once, and you're going to laugh.
You mean you experienced one once?
Or? I have experienced other things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I was watching one happen. But okay. The reason this is important is because it's so unusual. Bearing in mind, Central Java in the 90s, no one speaks English really. There's very little literature coming in and out at that time, you know. Anyway, so there was a guy, I can even remember his name. It's Chiplung, his name was. He was a Chinese guy, and he had this visceral reaction to things, and it was a fear that arose in him every now and then, and he had no way of accessing where this fear came from. So Siono, the teacher, he said, right, lie on the floor, we're going to relax you, we're going to take you back to this the source of this trauma. Anyway, what happened is just so funny. So this guy is lying flat on the floor, and as he's lying there, and there's a process you go through relaxing, and then it's a kind of like a guided meditation to take it. He started relaxing side, and as he started sort of like creasing up into this kind of a bit like a fetal position, and he started going, and he was like, and he said, I can't breathe properly, I can't breathe, and all these strange things, and then all of a sudden he was like, to cut a long story short, I'll tell you what he recounted as the experience. Okay. He went back to a former life where he wasn't even a human being. He was from God knows where, but it was another star system. And he was breathing through his stomach. He wasn't even air. It was energy. He was breathing through his stomach. And he was actually at the helm of a giant planet that he was, not a man-made planet. It was a bit like a Death Star, something like that. Mm-hmm. And this guy, and there were 60,000 people on this planet. And something he did while he was kind of at the helm of this planet caused the whole thing to get destroyed eventually. This is a long story, but the long story short is he basically killed 60,000 people in a former life in a completely different solar system. Anyway. And this is where this trauma came from, right? Now, I know that sounds out of this world, crazy, nonsense, or whatever. But it was interesting that there's no talk of alien life forms out in places like this, you know. Or even the way he described himself as this completely different shape, breathing through here. He described what he was seeing and doing and what happened and why he made an error which caused this terrible, catastrophic explosion, blah, blah, blah. But during that time I was there, I had a lot of very unusual experiences.
I imagine it's very visceral for you to be in the room, like while this is
happening.
I watched
many of them. Many of them.
I've talked to other people as well that have sat through sessions like that.
Well, I've had my own version of that have been quite simple. I mean, this is all going to sound really stupid and retarded. For example, one time, within Central Java, there are a number of deities, let's say. One of them is called Nyai Loru Kidul. She's the queen of the South Seas, and she lives in the South Seas. And even to this day, the king of Surakarta, which is the city I lived in, which is still now, every year he disappears for a week, and traditionally he's going to spend time with Nyai Loru Kidul, the queen of the South Seas. But if you read the if you read about the Queen of the South Seas and you read their texts about what all this is, you can start to understand a little bit. Anyway, I've been taken there myself. I really have. Mm-hmm. I really, you know, according to what I have experienced, I've been there. I've been, my eye, that is real beauty. I have, my eyes have been streaming with gratefulness for the beauty I'm experiencing in this place. The same goes for having psychedelic experiences. You are in places, I don't know whether you've had other ones where you...
Yeah, and it needn't even be with a substance, like with holotropic breathing and things like
right.
that.
Right,
like,
yeah, sure, sure.
You,
know,
you have altered states of consciousness.
Absolutely. Yeah, and even when I look back at all that stuff from the past and all the weird experiences I encountered coming, you know, there is a point in me now where I think, okay, what's going on here? The same with the psychedelic experience. What's going on? If you're not dealing with trauma and things like that, I understand you're accessing parts of yourself. Mm. But when it starts getting into the realm of, like, if you take DMT and you meet
But also for me, the first stuff, trip, like, what about the alien story? Like, you know, I
but did you meet
I'd
them?
Never been an aliens guy ever.
Did you meet them? Did you? What was it? A sense?
No, I had audible. But it was. You know how, like, when you talk about people with psychosis, like, they're just, their whole body is convinced of that. That was what it was like for me. Like, it was just there, and the machines were in the walls, and I had audio hallucinations that
machines.
You know,
I missed that bit.
Yeah, I said, like, I mean, my experience was, this is not a psychedelic. This is alien technology. They are projecting things onto my retina. Yeah, yeah.
Have you heard about the machine elves that people meet when they do DMT?
Machine elf? Well, yeah, I know that there's books about kind of like describing the various entities, right?
Do you hear a certain sound of like grinding metal? It's very difficult to explain it, but
I haven't done things like DMT and so no, but the specific grinding sound you're talking about, I don't remember that. It was more like a humming or a buzzing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then the extremely visceral thing was those what felt like waves of energy going through my body, and not like, oh, you know that thing where it's like, oh, my muscles are twitching. It's like, no. This is like, I don't know, like some just waves and waves and waves that keep going through your body, and you literally feel it, which is commonly reported, you know, in higher doses of ibogaine.
But as far as the going back to, you know, what we were talking
but
about,
so yeah, but it's interesting that when you're talking about the you know, generational trauma, that, like, you know, I was kind of almost like staying in the, you know, like almost like the Western medical realm of like, oh, you know, you pass it on. Whereas, like, you're talking about, well, it could be that you were on another continent, you know, that your let's say your soul, you know, was in another body, yeah, in another universe even, or, you know,
which is kind of like the,
which I'm open to, you know, I definitely think it's possible that literally right now, this is the dream. Like, I'm currently dreaming, you know, maybe I'm going to wake up sometime. Maybe me dying is going to be a waking up experience.
I mean, the concept of karma itself could be, that could be the mechanism of it. Mm. If you think about karma as living with the consequences of what you did in the past, that's kind of what it is in a way. Mm. I mean, you having an anxiety that is something that you have no idea why, is you living with basically your actions of the past or what happened to you.
Right.
In your case, was it that you feel that as a young baby, you were put on some kind of a ventilator and it was really...
Yeah, it's associated with a certain numbness in my mouth, even like a certain kind of a chemical type taste. There is kind of like... people with like what looks like white, you know, maybe like doctor's coats or something. There's more what looks like more like industrial lighting. There is a kind of a specific rhythm that I hear. It's often like, that's often what announces that the flashback is there. Like, I'm hearing that rhythm.
Like a machine.
And so that was the thing. In my second ibogaine trip, I had a numb lip and I didn't really think about it. But then when I went into the flashback the next night, it was there again. So it's like, oh, okay. So that was what made me link the two. It was like, wow, I think what I'm possibly experiencing in the Ibogaine trip is like, it's kind of, you know, how like fractals work, like you just take a little thing and you enlarge it. Mm. It's like, so then it looks very different, but you're still looking at the cells of whatever, an eggplant or something.
And also, I mean, there are a lot of people that say that trauma is held in physical places.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a commonly held idea.
Very common, yeah. And I think it's true. Like it's somehow stored in the body, especially if you think about like, people have come a long way. They used to think like, oh, but babies cannot experience trauma. They don't really feel pain, which is how they would justify doing all kinds of procedures, maybe even without sedation. And but yeah, it's well established now that babies do experience trauma, but they're pre-verbal. So how do you deal with that as an adult? You know, if you've had trauma before you could even process verbal memory.
All right, now, because I want to cover a few things.
Sure.
But I want to go, your talk here is about collectivism and the problems of collectivism, right?
Yeah, I did it yesterday. Yeah.
Oh, you've done it already, sorry.
Yeah. It was more about vices. I was kind of like walking people through Tolkien analogies and kind of like some of the personalities in Lord of the Rings and describing them as vices. So like Saruman is like pride, and then we have Gollum, who's self-loathing and so on. And then kind of my interpretation is that we're seeing this at large in Europe. And then so the answer, rather than like, oh, we need to like pick up our weapons and fight, which in some way happens in Lord of the Rings, but I think really the message, it's much more personal, and it's about virtues, like cultivating virtues in yourself and like, you know, finding hope in dark places and having humility and you know, those kind of basic virtues. That was my talk.
And I'm not a Tolkien fan. I did look up, what was that word?
Mithril.
Mithril. I looked it up and I see where you're going with that. Are you saying that, did Tolkien understand all this when he wrote
it? Yes, so he lost all but one of his best friends in the Great War, you know, because he was 22 when it started. So his friends all went to war and almost all of them died. The war itself, but then also, I mean, he was a Catholic and very consciously he created the world of Middle Earth as a kind of a giant allegory. He might take issue with how I interpreted parts of it, but he's in letters and stuff he's written about, and same with J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter, you know, that it's like part of why, you know, people aren't really ready to talk religion right, you know, these days, but clearly if it's woven into the art, it resonates. You know, it's more than just a story. Like it kind of helps us remember that these virtues really do matter.
So is that how you see the best path forward to dealing with, obviously Bitcoin is a real life thing that you can actually use as a protest to this situation, are you?
Right.
But are you, do you think as a human, other than something like that, your duty is to rekindle these particular virtues or whatever?
Well, I don't know about duty, but it's like the punishment is in the avoidance. Like, you know, if you're living as an addict and you're constantly trying to hide and escape, like you live in agony. And so it's more like, you know, it's kind of like, if anything, I feel like I've kind of discovered this path, which a lot of other people have. It's not unique. And I'm just trying to help people find it too, you know? But yeah, like for example, the link with like holding Bitcoin and stuff in the talk is, let's see, one of the vices is really, I call them like the ghosts that are roaming through Europe, is self-loathing, which immediately gets projected because it's too hard to say, I hate myself. Usually people don't say that, but they start talking very grimly about other people and society. But I think the opposite of that is, you know, self-love and self-liberation and taking responsibility, which, you know, is hodling, you know, and not your keys, not your coins, those kind of things. So it's a very practical thing that we can do that kind of, and that's the mithril idea. Like mithril in itself is just a metal, but in that story of Lord of the Rings, you know, it was mined by these, like, you know, consistent dwarves with all their power. And then the elves, you know, they would smelt it and create the mail out of it. And then it's gifted to Frodo by this mysterious woman, Galadriel. And so it's like a symbol of, you know, friendship and courage. And so it gives him hope and courage throughout his journey. And then it also physically saves his life when the giant spider pierces him with the fangs. He doesn't die because he's actually wearing the chainmail. So I just thought it was, you know, that these objects, I think in some way, you can say they're just objects, but they become so important in the story because they represent something, right? They represent this virtue or this story or the gift or the friendship.
So what are the main addictions then that you see? Let's try and be as practical as we can here. Mm-hmm. I'm all for, like, solving these problems.
Sure.
And I think, in fact, it said that you talk about practical strategies in the talk, is that right?
Yes,
for Europeans, but in particular, was it?
Or? Yes, but because, like, for me, because I only have my own kind of story to rely on, I often feel that the answers are pretty obvious. Like, just, you know, store your own coins, do multi-sig, you know, think about a plan B, take care of your family. It's basic stuff. But the big challenge, I think, especially here in Europe, is how do you go from stuckness and inertia to actually moving? How do you do that? How do you live a free life if everyone around you is acting like they're prisoners and slaves? You know, they're stuck. So to me, it's like the real challenge is getting out of stuckness, and that's kind of where I'm kind of like, okay, well, let's identify how are we shackled. And that's how I came. Yeah, I've been working on this for like 10 years just to try and, like, have a more or less coherent, like, theory of you know, ethics and things like that. And so, yeah, like, I think that the lowest layer, if you think about the you know, the Bitcoin is a protocol stack. You always have a bottom layer, a foundation. I think that is terror, like the experience of terror, which is not bad in itself, but the despair. I think despair is the foundation of any kind of dysfunction, addiction, because it's so excruciating. And then the layer on top of that is self-loathing. You know, you have that, like, you would try to escape the despair by saying, like, oh, but it's just that I'm bad, so maybe I can fix it. And then you can have another layer on top of that, which is envy, which is like, oh, but maybe I'm not bad, maybe the other ones are bad. And so you start judging. You're like, oh, and then you start kind of having that resentment and this passive aggression and like, you know, and because you feel like you're isolated still. And so you come up with all these stories. And then the final layer, which I think is, you know, Sauron is like the, and Saruman in the Lord of the Rings is pride, is like narcissism. It's like, I am God. That's the ultimate delusion. But they're all just layers of stories to hide the knowledge that you are terrified at one point and that you had despair and you lost hope.
I've never heard that explained in that way before. So can we go back to the despair then again?
Yeah.
Give me an example in your own life of where you discovered despair.
Well, I mean, when I was 16, I thought of committing suicide, you know? I thought I was condemned to live the life that I saw adults live around me, which was addiction, which was stuckness, which was that kind of, like, I remember my best friend in elementary school, this kind of, like, he had this aliveness when he was, like, 11. We were best friends, and, like, he was, like, always laughing. And then I met him again, because we split ways going to high school, right? Met him again when he was like 15, and I felt like something had died, you know? And that reminded me of, and maybe it did or didn't, I don't know, but it was just, that was my great fear, is to to have this spiritual death and just live my life like an adult zombie. And that was, you know, that was my, the root of my depression in my teenage years was like, can I escape this potential fate? You know, like, and so I was like, also like, there was a lot of relativism and determinism in the kind of books I was reading. And so that's why Austrian School Economics, Mises, Human Action, he comes out of the gate blasting, saying like, determinism is bullshit, free will exists, the truth exists. And it like, it was like, all of a sudden I could breathe again. You know, that's why that was so important.
That's amazing. And as far as collectivism goes, is collectivism a byproduct of this hierarchy of despair, self-loathing, envy? Because you end up looking to other people to it's a version of being insecure and then, or not being self-sovereign. You don't look to yourself because you can't stand it.
Yeah.
You look to the collective for your, whatever it is. Or in your case, also you talk about the addictions are the place you look as well. But is there, what is the, like, is collectivism bad? You know, is it inherently a bad idea?
Or? I think it's a symptom of pride. So like, you know, like the primeval evil characters in like Lord of the Rings or the ones that have the most power, they have pride. And so that means they see themselves as gods, which means everybody else is lower, is beneath them, is subhuman, can be manipulated, can't take care of themselves, are, you know, not even children that will grow into human beings, but they're just like the orcs, right? They're just disposable. And that's kind of, you know, Marx as well. Like, that's the pride. And so that's why I think it's so important when you study these figures like Hitler and Marx, is to kind of go to their early writings and see kind of like, what is their psychology? Like, how do they think about themselves? And it's hard because you have to, there's a lot implied. It's rare that people actually reveal their most inner convictions because it's so painful. They'll often spin stories that project. But yeah, and I think often people also create their, if you are avoidant, you create in the world your greatest fears. So your fear is to be stuck. So you create stuckness for everybody else.
Mm. I think Jordan Peterson would mention the word disgust at that point as well. There's an element of that in the self-loathing aspect of it.
Yeah, know? No, absolutely. And so I use for in the talk, envy. I take Grima Wormtongue as the personification of that. And so that's the passive aggression. It's Grima is Old English for mask. So it's like a person who's disingenuous. And so, yeah, I always, you know, it's also in the movie, right? He's the advisor to Theoden the King. And he has that kind of like a, it's a disgust that he has. Like he's constantly judging. Deep down, he's judging himself. But of course, you know, in reality, he's just judging everybody else. And so constantly he's disgusted by everything.
I think that's I think a symptom of that in the Bitcoin world is this notion of the pleb being no one's above you, no one's below you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an important...
Which
noticed,
is, I think, humility. You yes. know? To me, that's the opposite of pride. It's humility. It's like, we're all plebs, you know? Yeah. We're just all in this together.
It's an interesting strategy of owning that word as well, because I've met people who didn't get that, who thought, oh, don't say that, that's embarrassing.
You're right.
And there are so many examples of subcultures owning the slanders against them.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And you like, wear it as armor, right?
Exactly.
In Game of Thrones, Tyrion, he's the disfigured dwarf, and he says like all the insults, I wear them like armor, which is, you know, you flip it around. You like the psychopaths, like Bitcoiners are psychopaths. Like hell yeah,
yeah.
Like literally every insult that's been hurled at Bitcoiners, mountain men.
I know.
Yeah, we're the mountain men.
You're right. None of them.
Like, and also in the 1500s, right? Like you guys are beggars, the sea beggars. Like we're the sea beggars, and so they became the rebels. Like they wore it like armor.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely phenomenal. Can I go back to this kind of your talk again?
Sure.
We've got minutes.
Let's say 15.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. How did it go down in that room?
Well, I had my in-ear monitors, so I could, because you in a big room, you always hear the echo and it's delayed and it's really confused. It's disorienting. So I was a bit insulated from the audience.
I mean, is it too soon?
What mattered was that I felt like I was there with what I was talking about. And so I could feel what I was talking about, which has always been my goal. It's been really hard to achieve because you get self-conscious or... So I feel great about how it went for me, and I've had good feedback. So it was in that sense, I'm happy. But you know, I think the jury's out a little bit. I'm curious to see once the video drops what people will say about it.
I think my experience of Bitcoiners in general is that there is a strong, and I'm going to say this word, think boy aspect, which is normally where these conversations go.
It's funny because it's like related to soy boy. It's like a little, like there's exactly. Like that disingenuous, is that what you mean? Yeah, like disingenuous?
Well, it's just, well, if you want me to break it down, it's the thinkers that aren't aware.
Yes.
They're not aware, yes. Right? And I think that's quite a lot of people.
There's also like this subreddit, I am 14 and this is deep. So I think, you know, I'm like a teenager, but I think I'm so profound.
I'm not. I listen to all these people, and because I think what I learn a lot from this aspect, but it's very evident when I'm listening that there is this complete that there's a non-experience of awareness a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And things you're talking about. And I wonder whether there is going to be a point in the future when that side of the Bitcoin world starts becoming more better known, let's say, you know.
And it might be, because so often in history that something humbling has to happen. Like whatever the think boy thing is, I think it goes hand in hand with a certain amount of arrogance. Like you kind of overestimate yourself because the ego wants to feel like it's strong and powerful. And so then you just kind of take too many risks and then eventually the reality hits, which are also like with addictions, like you hit rock bottom and then that's the you know. So that's the one thing I'm a little bit fearful for. Like what if enough Bitcoiners go into that arrogance of like, you know.
Well, I mean, in my case, my version of it would be me using intellectual ideas to create a barrier between me and other people, which is, think we all do it. I'm always battling it.
Yeah, it's tempting.
But I think that's, I mean, and this is all very specific things, but I wouldn't say it's a problem or anything like that, but it is something I notice. And I think in my life, the ability to be in my body has helped me just so much. And the opposite of being in your body is being very intellectual. Mm-hmm. That's my experience of it.
And it also means that it's almost like a bait for young people who are challenged and who struggle with being in their body. It's almost like, you know, bait. It's like an invitation to join the cult of the brain, right? Mm.
And the problem probably is that within our bodies, there is a lot of discomfort and self-loathing, and which is a result of of everything.
Yeah.
The fiat world is, this is why I think this all comes back together. There's this overarching experience of why the fiat world causes, is self-perpetuating despair, I suppose it would be, wouldn't it? And you know, the way out is to enlighten those parts of your life, and you can't do it with intellectualism.
You can't
go there. It doesn't exist. It's the opposite, in fact. It's you trying to use your ability to decipher something as a barrier, as a way to not address it.
Well, and that's why, you know, in like 12-step programs and AA, like the first step is like, I am powerless. Like you admit that, you know, you can't think your way out of things. You have to like take a moment and be like, look, there is so much I don't know. There's so much I don't control. So you're like checking in with humility, often for the first time. And so that's weirdly a non-cerebral thing to actually try and do that. Like, I am powerless over so many things.
My old teacher, going back to that in Indonesia, he used to, Oh God, I just realized something. His symbol outside of his Buddhist life was the letter B. Because his theory was just B. Right?
Oh, yeah,
he would say that in any situation in your life, it's funny that it's a B. I never made the connection before. There's no connection, but it's just interesting.
There might be.
There might be. He'd know nothing about Bitcoin over there, but his strategy would always be, look, when you have a problem, is the first thing you do is accept the reality as it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Number one, you just be. You have to accept it. You can't do that without awareness. So your training for us, for me, for a year and a half, was learning how to sit in your awareness.
It's
and
funny.
He
yeah.
used the body as the way. So there would be meditations to basically feel your body,
feel
the relaxation of your body. And it would bring your awareness into this place. And suddenly, after everyone went through it, there's this point when you realize, wait a minute, my thoughts are actually something else. I am not my thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a journey of the West, I think. The Western mind is like absorbed in the... And I think you even see that in architecture when you look at brutalist architecture.
Mm.
You see this square, logical, you know, it's literally a manifestation of what someone's thinking are. Whereas when you see beautiful buildings, it's different. It's a manifestation of the feeling.
Walking around in my hometown, walking around in Prague, what is so clear to me is that there's all these beautiful buildings and then there's literally infinite amounts of beautiful views. As you move through, you take one step to the left, there's beauty in a different, like every angle is different because it has that organicness to it. And like you say, like the brutalism, the modernism, it's squares, it's like endless rows. And so in a way, metaphorically, it's almost like it's telling us this is a dead end. Like it's sameness. By the way, when you were talking about your teacher, it reminded me of when I first read some of the, like, you know, Zen teachings, and there's all these, you know, the little anecdotes of like this, you know, this little, you know, young monk like asked the question, and it's like almost invariably the answer is just confusing and bewildering, and it's kind of like a joke, like what like you're making a joke out of me, and I feel like part of what's happening is just the teacher is just being like, you are in your thinking brain. Let me just scramble that for a bit. Like, it's almost like in a playful way. Like, hey, like, you know, and it let me help you snap out of that.
And it comes hand in hand with judgment as well. The process of judgment is often considered a block to the path to, you know, heaven or whatever it is. If you're interested in stuff like that, you should look into, there's a Bhutanese bodhisattva called Drukpa Khunli. They call him in Bhutan, they call him the divine madman. And it's so funny because it's such a funny meme. But he was a drunk, a philanderer. He was rude. He was all these things. But he was an enlightened bodhisattva. Mm. And he did this, obviously, as a teaching for people to not judge him.
Oh, interesting. Right. Interesting.
But it's funny because he could be the biggest troll of all time, or it could be absolutely true.
You could even think of like the tax collector, like all the sinners that Jesus interacts with. It's like, well, maybe they're just manifestations of the divine as well. They're just kind of like, you know, they're here to teach us something.
Well, like you said, everything is a projection going outwards. You mentioned it earlier. Whatever you are you're looking at your thing, right? Okay, sorry. We'll wrap it up. A final thought then from you. It could be anything.
It's funny that you ask me that because it's almost like a, you know, like there's an inherent lesson because like if I had like the final thought to wrap it all up, like that would be a very cerebral thing to do, right?
Okay. No, you just reminded me of something. I've got one story to tell in 2 minutes
because
it goes back to psychedelics. Sure. There's a really phenomenal book that I've got in my library. I can't remember who it's by, but it's about some guys. Do you know what the mushroom that you get in Northern Europe that's got spots on it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Right. Amanita muscaria.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
They thought that they had this theory that soma, which is an Indian, you know, they had this theory that soma was this mushroom. And so they sort of decided to study it intensely, and they took it really intensely, to the point where they took it 30 days consecutively, I think. And by the 30th day, they were eating like 5 or 6 whole caps. I mean, it was really intense.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they thought it was the way to find enlightenment, as in the tradition of Soma, because there were so many crossovers. Anyway, the final moment before enlightenment is a really interesting story. The guy recounts it in the book. He's sitting cross-legged alone, having taken like 12 of these mushrooms or something. And suddenly he is in, do you remember, there's a parable in the Bible where the lady with an alabaster jar, I think.
I'm not sure if I remember.
Right. Well, there's a lady walking down a street and she's got an alabaster jar on her head with olives in it. Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of hole in the jar and the olives are dropping out one by one. Mm-hmm. And he's sitting there and he's, it's like when you're tripping, you're there, you are that thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He is this parable. And he realizes that the alabaster jar is his mind and the olives are thoughts. Mm-hmm. And as the last one drops out, he goes,
oh, that's awesome. That is awesome.
Wow. And yeah. Maybe we should just stop there.
It's so like that. I mean, Amanita, I studied it quite a bit. It's interesting because it's actually legal across the U.S. Mm-hmm. And but if you read the literature, it's very popular in Russia, actually, and a lot of Russians, because you can't really grow it artificially. You have to find it in the forest, and there's a lot of it in Russia.
Under birch trees.
But maybe just a word of caution, because people have taken high doses and. There is a reason why people think the berserkers might have been, you know, crazy Vikings that took a lot of this stuff, because it can give you the delusion of like ultimate power, and people have literally jumped out of windows on this stuff. So definitely, you know, something to...
I think they advise you to have about a square that much from the top to begin with.
Right.
But yeah, I mean...
And that's why they also recommend the tea, because you can put a bunch of caps together and then you can have a more of a... It's more predictable how much of a dose you're taking, because apparently cap per cap, it varies a lot.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. Anyway, look, thanks for talking. This ended up nothing to do with but that's perfect.
I love the story, by the way, the last olive. That's fantastic.
I know, because it really, there's very hard to describe. But
yeah.
Anyway, thanks for coming in. And yeah, let's do it again sometime. And good luck with your own journey as well.
Yeah, I think you're just a brilliant interviewer. Like, I just love how kind of free your mind is, you know. It's quite wonderful.
Thank you. It's not that free, you'd be surprised, but anyway, thanks.
You're welcome.